Hello, everybody, and welcome. You're listening to the Leadership Focus, an internet radio show geared to everyday leadership, both at work and throughout your life. Each week, we present you with new ideas, interesting guests, and actionable strategies to help you be an incredible leader with a more balanced life. I'm your host, Lisa Pasbjorg, Executive Coach and CEO of Focus Coaching, a leadership coaching and training firm based in Ann Arbor, Michigan. And tonight, our topic is startling news about retaliation. Are you at risk? And our guest tonight is Dr. Lee Hollis. Dr. Hollis is a noted author, educator, trainer, and researcher. After receiving her bachelor's degree from Rutgers and master's degree from the University of Pittsburgh, she went on to receive her doctorate in administration, training, and policy studies at Boston University. An expert on the topic of retaliation, Lee is the author of the acclaimed book, Unequal Opportunity, by Wingspan Press. Her exemplary career in higher education administration includes both senior leadership and faculty positions, and she has continued her education and passion for the subject in additional professional training at Harvard, Stanford, and Cornell. We welcome her knowledge and expertise tonight on the Leadership Focus. I'm sure she has a lot to share with us. Welcome, Lee.
Hi, hello. Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's wonderful to have you here. What a background. First, what got you interested in this area?
Several friends had mentioned how this was happening to them increasingly, and this was even 5 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't want to complain about discrimination at work, were facing sexual harassment at work, or even somebody has a temporary disability because of a stroke or a pregnancy, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And we're running into some very unfair practices. And what happens is people think, okay, it's work. They call it work because it's work. So it's supposed to be hard. And as I started doing some more research, I found it is not just bad business. Many of the practices were illegal.
Mm-hmm.
And folks were taking it to the EEOC or taking it to an attorney or coming up with strategies to combat this, especially in a recession. And then
mm-hmm.
I found out that my friends are not unlike lots of other people who are like, what's that movie in the 70s? I'm just not going to take it anymore. And so
mm-hmm.
they're exercising their right for a fair and equitable workplace. And so that's what got me into the subject. And the more I find out, the more I want to find out, because I'm very much into equality, both for employers and employees, and just having a great place to work so we can be creative and productive.
Yeah, yeah, I hear you. So let's start out with some definitions. What is retaliation, technically, from a legal standpoint?
Sure. Well, in layman's terms, it's I, one, exercise my civil rights. Two, the organization is put on notice that I've done so. Three, something bad happens to my employment status. Bad meaning not just terminated or separated, but expansion of retaliation includes transfer, demotion, change of hours. So I exercise my civil rights, something bad happens, that's retaliation. So what amazes me is that it's a very easy thing to avoid, but over 36% of the complaints launched with the EEOC are because someone faces retaliation because they exercise their civil rights.
Mm-hmm. And when you talk about exercise your civil rights, what are some examples of what people do and then someone retaliates? I mean, this may seem really simple to you, but I think it would be helpful to listeners to hear some examples.
Sure, not a problem. Young lady tells her boss, I don't like that you touch me. You don't have to put your hand on my shoulder when we're at the computer. I don't like that you call me baby. Quit complaining about my lipstick. The boss continues. So she then complains to human resources, who fires her. She's complaining that she's being treated differently because she's a woman,
mm-hmm.
and then she's fired. Another example might be a gentleman has a car accident. He breaks his leg. He is now entitled to reasonable accommodation under Americans with Disabilities Act. It's a temporary disability if he has a wheelchair or some other walking apparatus. He wants his office to be retrofitted so he can get in and out of work. Instead of accommodating the disability, the organization fires him. That's the retaliatory action. So retaliation is usually caught is always caught within some other complaint. I complain because you keep telling me racial jokes. I don't like it. I tell you to stop. You keep telling the jokes. I go to HR. You transfer me because I don't fit. Well, I just don't want to hear the racial jokes, and that's retaliation.
And you transfer me someplace that's a less desirable place.
And less, yes, and less desirable could be as simple as I used to have the 8-to-4 shift, and I have kids or I have to take care of my elderly father, but now you transferred me to the 3-to-9 shift or the 3-to-10 shift. Well, now you've overturned my life because I've got child care issues or somebody has to come and take care of my dad or what have you. So it doesn't have to be tangible loss. You demoted me financially. It could be you transferred me to a less desirable shift or something that is inconvenient for me, something that a reasonable person would find a hardship because of the change.
Now, when you talk about disabilities, and you mentioned temporary disabilities, but you know, the new law, when I talk to my HR friends regarding the breadth and the scope of what's considered a disability at work is much expanded. Do you anticipate that there are going to be more retaliation claims because more people are actually considered to have disabilities and are requesting accommodations at work?
Well, it's expanding for a couple reasons. First of all, the public is more aware of these rules, and we have more access. So everybody has a computer at home, or you can get the news through your phone, or we are much more connected. The other reason why I anticipate a rise in disability claims is you have 2.3 million disabled vets coming back from Afghanistan and Iraq. We've been at war, and so folks have not just the physical injuries with a missing limb or some compromised physical ability. You also have post-traumatic stress. You also have some other cognitive disabilities, which are also covered. And organizations need to be prepared to accommodate folks, not just veterans, but anybody who has a disability. So I anticipate a bump because, you know, our vets are coming home too, and organizations, it's a little bit more expensive to take care of people with disabilities, but that's the law, reasonable accommodation.
How does retaliation differ or overlap with such things as harassment or bullying or just generally unpleasant coworkers and supervisors?
That's a great question. Bullying is something that is very much on the rise across the country. It creates an unhealthy workplace. And the cross-section with retaliation would be, let me back up and define bullying, which is very similar to harassment. It's constant, it's pervasive, it's continuous, it's escalating. The difference between bullying and harassment is that harassment occurs when it's a dominant class, the person in power, against a protected class. The protected class is under Title VII are women, minorities based on race, color, religious background, disability, pregnancy. Bullying happens when it's status-free, where it could be a white male bullying a white male, or it could be a white female bullying a white female. So there isn't an obvious protected class, if you will. It doesn't mean that the bullying is less harmful. And in fact, more people face bullying and the stress of bullying than people face sexual harassment issues. Bullies, by the nature of bullying and coming after a target and making them feel bad, are likely to retaliate. So if I complain that somebody has treated me unfairly because I'm a woman, and the bully is now ticked off, how dare you complain against me, the bullying kind of personality is more likely to come after the person who reported it, and now you have the recipe for a retaliation charge. And they're pretty easy to define. I complained, and then you changed my status. Those are easier to define than the other ones. So that would be where it occurs. What is a shame about the bullying and the harassment piece, while harassment, sexual harassment, facing harassment because of racial issues is illegal, bullying is still technically legal. And that becomes very difficult. Some people have sued, calling it emotional distress. And that threshold is very high. I mean, you almost have to be sick and going through all kinds of trauma to prove that kind of stress. But there are a number of states that are starting, at least on the secondary level in the school systems, to outlaw bullying or to prohibit bullying. And I see a number of colleges and universities, at least in my area, which are having anti-bullying policies that are sitting right along with their anti-harassment and anti-retaliation policies.
You know, I understand from your book and some of the material that I've been reading that retaliation statistics, as reported by the EEOC, are way, way, way up. Can you tell us more about that?
Well, I'll empathize with the employer here as I answer the question. Are workplaces in general still facing budget cuts, still facing some very real fiscal challenges, having to do more with less? That cliche is a very real thing. So you have a stressed-out employer, and in the advent of a RIF or a reduction in force, people facing the RIF feel that they've been unfairly let go. And so now the organization is vulnerable. You have employers who are susceptible to making more emotional decisions because of the stress, because of the pressure, and in there becomes a breach of the law of retaliation or some of the other discriminatory things that we've talked about. When folks are under pressure, when leadership is under pressure and you're overstimulated, you make bad decisions. And in this economy, it's a whole lot easier to make bad decisions because the money is not nearly as prevalent as we would like it to be in our organization.
You know, I would think also when people are laid off or otherwise disengaged with the organization or the employer, that they know it's going to be much, much harder for them to find a comparable job in this economy.
Absolutely.
So, you know, they feel much more desperate, whereas if they knew that tomorrow three headhunters would call them and offer them three lovely positions and they could choose between them, it would probably be a non-issue. They just, you know, move on.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that makes it harder too. So it's a,
sure,
in many ways a perfect storm for that to happen.
Yes, I've actually entitled a lecture on that, the perfect storm and retaliation. Yes, there was a recent study, I saw it on the Nightly News about a month ago, whereas while I think there was a bump in employment last month, people were going back to work, and maybe it's a seasonal thing, but those people returning to work, only 7% reported that they had recovered the same economic stability that they had before they had lost their original job. So I agree, absolutely, it's more desperate out there. Also, even what's on the dockets for Washington before they go away is extending unemployment benefits. It used to be,
right,
I believe it was six or 9 months, and now the extension is to 12 and 18 months, and people can extend. So it is much tougher to get a job, and the average lawsuit, if you go all the way from complaint to sitting before the judge, it's about 22 months.
Yeah.
If it's taking 3 years to find a job, a lot of folks are thinking, I might as well roll the dice and sue. And so employers need to keep that in mind. Do you really want to be embroiled in a lawsuit, or do you want to take your time and follow the numbers in HR about what is right and equitable by federal law? Because people are now willing to endure the 2 years because it's so long to get, takes so long to get a job.
Yeah. It's worth it to them,
mm-hmm,
to go through that often agonizing process. So what should an organization do that, say, has a new supervisor or a group of relatively new supervisors, and the organization knows that they're going to be restructuring, or, you know, maybe even the manager will be charged with cleaning house in a department?
Sure.
What should be included?
First, the organization should recognize they have introduced what is called a new actor. So if you had, say, a vice president in place for 20 years and he had a certain way of dealing with his staff. Maybe he had flex time. Maybe he allowed telecommuting. Maybe he let them go Fridays in the summer at 1. Whatever it was, there has been an established practice. So when you bring in a new actor, and that new actor starts changing the rules, so it can change whether a young lady can go take care of her kid at a certain time. And it can change somebody's flexibility to run back and forth and pick up a parent in, you know, after surgery or for outpatient care. And it changes a number of things. So now you have a new actor, and then they start evaluating people differently, and then the people get upset, and they have a case. I've been working for 20 years, and I have all these records proving I have done quality work for the organization. Now all of a sudden you brought in this new actor who is picking on me because I'm Muslim, because I'm a woman, because I have olive skin, or whatever class, color, race, religion. And the complainant has a case because they have 20 years, 15 years, even 3 years of a good standing record. And now the new actor is saying it's unacceptable. And so organizations get into trouble when they have the new actor. The new actor changes things, and now we have an adverse employment action. And the complainant gets upset, and they do have a case in that area. So organizations need to be careful. The second thing they need to do, organizations need to do, is train your new actor. Don't assume that you just gave them the HR handbook and everybody knows what it is. A new person has enough things to worry about, as simple as learning the email system and how to work the electronic calendar and, you know, learning what works with the new administrative assistant. And on top of that, expect them to read the employment handbook. You should have training for your new supervisors to let them know what's acceptable, what's not, what decisions, and also to let them know who's been your trouble people. Organizations fall short where they don't follow their own policies and they don't document performance issues. So a new actor comes in and says, you know, Sally has not been performing well. And they say, oh, yeah, she's been like that for years. But if you look in Sally's file, there has been nothing to document the problem, and it causes a bigger issue for the new actor who can see that Sally is not performing but does not have the support of the organization with bad record keeping to do anything about it. So a new actor invites all kinds of different challenges, all of which can be overcome, but it takes patience and training and proper documentation to get through it.
That's the classic. Mm-hmm. When someone has been in a leadership role and they don't have the courage or the chutzpah to document things,
mm-hmm.
and then someone comes in and people say, why aren't you getting rid of this person? They've been doing this for years. It's awful. It's inappropriate. And you're starting at the beginning of the process,
yeah.
with the step process with getting them out of there, because there's zero in the file.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And it, a statute that's not exercised a lot, but it is on the books, managers and supervisors can be personally liable for decisions. So if you, as a new supervisor or a new actor, are coming into an organization and you're being asked to clean house and you don't have the records, you don't have the support, but you take action anyway, that complainant can not only come after the organization, but can also personally name and hold accountable the supervisor who did the action. So a new actor needs to be careful as well and be very aware of what their responsibilities are under the law to their employees, even if they are acting out.
You know, I do a lot of work with hospitals. Mm. And hospitals today, healthcare, there's so much merging and reconfiguring, and you know, this small rural hospital now is under this big larger umbrella, and temporary, you know, interim CEOs coming in and that kind of thing, and I wonder, even at that level, at the C level, the senior leadership level, how much training they get about those things, because often, you know, that's what they're charged to do, is to,
right.
you know, make the balance, the budget balance, and clean things up. And
right.
if they come in and there's a history of fair to much better than fair performance evaluations and nothing in the file, and then they're told that they need to get rid of this person, that could be a problem. a real problem. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So
the other interesting policy that's out there is called cat's paw theory.
Yeah.
And there have been rulings about that. Whereas, let's suppose a new vice president comes in, and they have right below them Manager A. And Manager A has a problem with staff member B because, I don't know, a different religion. So the manager comes to the new VP and says, my staff member has been coming late, my staff member hasn't been doing this, my staff member hasn't been doing that. And the middle manager convinces the vice president to take action. If the vice president takes action without documenting it themselves and finding out themselves and going back to that original staff member themselves, they can be caught up in what's called cat's paw theory, where there's racial or anti-religious or anti-veteran animus in the organization, and the supervisor is duped into taking the discriminatory action unwittingly. So there was a case, I believe it was Coca-Cola, where somebody off on another place, another organization, but in the same region, was coming late to work. And the reason for coming late was a medical reason or something like that. Mm-hmm. And the supervisor goes to central HR and reports all these late documentations. Central administration fires the person, and the person comes back and says, you didn't even interview me, and you didn't find out the reasons why. And the truth of the matter was, the boss, my immediate supervisor, had racial animus against me. And you took his word without finding out about mine and terminated me. And they ended up paying. You've got to be careful when you separate somebody based on somebody else's word. It's called cat's paw theory.
Interesting. It's an interesting term. We'll all remember that. Well, and I think about those incidences, too, where in the past they've made those exceptions for people for good reasons. Mm-hmm. And there's an understanding. So there's this perception that it's okay, and then for some reason it's not okay with this person, and they get nailed on it. And that's interesting. And what about, and in your book, what about third-party retaliation? Is that the same thing as cat's paw, or is that a little different?
Third-party retaliation. By association, meaning if, for example, a supervisor has racial animus, and an assistant is Caucasian, and the Caucasian marries somebody of Asian descent. And so the supervisor fires the white employee because he's associated with somebody of another race. That is a third party or by association. Another way that comes up, it happens quite a bit with mothers who have special needs children or have a special needs spouse. And so the supervisor gives the woman a hard time because of her association with, I have to go deal with my special needs child, or my husband has an ADA thing and is confined to a wheelchair, so I must leave at these different times to take care of him. And so while the female staff member does not have the ADA issue, she is trying to accommodate somebody, and that can come up, yeah, and you got to be careful with that. Absolutely.
Yeah, I bet it comes up. More often than not,
More often than not. And especially with all
these
vets coming home that we talked about.
You
will have more people coming home with disabilities, and so that particular issue is something to particularly guard against. Absolutely.
They do one of these no exceptions kinds of things, you know. Doesn't matter. But they're actually retaliating.
Right.
Interesting.
Yeah. And no exception doesn't mean you can't have reasonable accommodation.
Right. I understand. It always fascinates me because I've dealt quite a bit with disabilities. And the people that say, well, I can't do that for this person because then I'd have to do it for everybody and it wouldn't be fair. And I always have to explain to them, no, it's the other way around, that accommodating this person levels the playing field. It makes it more fair, closer to fair, than the other way around. But they're looking at it as if it's some great advantage.
Right.
It's really funny.
It's really not.
Was there or has there been a particular case that especially startled you or stood out as just you couldn't believe it? It was
You know, I have to give the Denzel Washington answer, which is it's always the next case. His answer is it's always the next script that I find most interesting. I am always amazed when I go on to websites or get the news feed on the latest case, and when I read the summaries and see somebody complaining, you fired them. And I want to say, how many times does that have to happen before people realize when somebody complains, you can't fire them for speaking up?
Mm-hmm.
And that amazes me that I continue to read how somebody comes forward and says, there was one at Walmart, $275,000. An employee had cancer surgery, complained that he was not accommodated, they fired him. And I want to say, don't you know?
It seems like the most basic thing.
Very basic. And
you,
it, yeah.
Yeah. I'll tell you, I like the Denzel Washington answer. And you know, I like anything Denzel says, actually. So.
Yeah. And it's always the next case.
Yeah.
We'll read something next week. Someone complained, they were fired.
So we're getting close to the end of our time here, but I'm wondering if you could tell us, if somebody's listening, and I'm sure there are lots of people listening that are employers, and they're thinking, whoa, you know, I'm not sure everybody's on board with this. What's the first step an employer should take to make sure they're on the right track with this issue?
Make sure you have a very good HR anti-retaliation policy in place and follow it. Just because you have a policy doesn't mean your staff is trained to apply that policy appropriately. Follow your own policies. The second thing I would say, if somebody complains about their civil rights, you need to look at every little step you take with them at least 6 to 9 months out before you change their employment action, whether their complaint was valid or not. Guard against retaliation. Those are the two biggest things I would say.
Mm-hmm. Great advice, really great advice. And I would add to that, you need to train, and then you need to train again, and then you need to train again, because you can't train people and have 4 years go by and say, okay, everybody's still doing it. There's just,
right.
You know, there's some drift. People forget, and new people come in, and they didn't get trained, or they didn't get trained as well, and you need to retrain and bring people up to speed and give them a specific example so they're going, oh, that's what they mean.
And the rules change.
Yeah, absolutely.
Five changes in 2011 alone. Yes. Mm-hmm.
They change frequently. So this has been really fascinating, and I've certainly learned some things just from talking to you, and I know our listeners have too. What other resources can you recommend for them, and how can they reach you or get more information, find your book, et cetera? Can you share some stuff about that?
On my website, diversitytrainingconsultants.com, there is a link to the ebook. So that's a great resource. It's very accessible without all that legal lingo.
Great.
I also offer a webinar series on also offering HRCI credits for practitioners to learn more about Title VII updates, bullying in the workplace, and how to create a healthy workplace. And I also love to send people to the EEOC website because you can see the latest things that they are advising as well. And I look at the EEOC website frequently myself.
Wonderful. Well, thank you very much. This has been very informative. Thank you for joining us tonight on the Leadership Focus, the show which gives you new ideas, interesting guests, and actionable strategies to help you be an incredible leader in a balanced life. We hope that you've enjoyed the show. If you have, please go to blogtalkradio.com and become a friend. Make it a favorite. Sign up for our free newsletter with 4 tips and strategies you can use. Go to focuscoaching.net on the web. It's focuscoaching.net on the web. Until next time, this is your host, Lisa Pasbjorg, urging you to be a better leader every day.